Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While we are in a public health pandemic, my guest today says we are also in a political epidemic of insecurity and mistrust, which is exacerbating our health crisis. Today we meet Abdul El Sayed, an epidemiologist, a public health expert, and progressive activist. A Rhodes Scholar, a Columbia University MD, and a professor at Columbia's Department of Epidemiology, El Sayed left academia to rebuild the city of Detroit's public health department, which had been privatized to disastrous results after the city's bankruptcy in 2012. There he worked to lower sulfur dioxide emissions, improve air quality for asthmatics, tackle Detroit's lead paint issues for children and in drinking water. For his work in turning around the health department, he was awarded the Public Official of the Year Award by the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. But in 2018, he left that post to run for governor of Michigan on a progressive platform, finishing second in the Democratic primary. Today, he is the chair of Southpaw Michigan, a progressive action group, and is an advocate for Medicare for All. He's also a contributor to CNN. He tells his own story as the child of Egyptian immigrants and offers an epidemiologist's diagnosis of our body politic, as well as a progressive prescription, in his new book, Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Abdul El Sayed, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Your book describes a political epidemic largely built on what you say is insecurity, economic insecurity, health insecurity, political, community, housing, and otherwise. I just have to ask you, given your background as an epidemiologist, how has this political epidemic that you describe affected the epidemiological pandemic the U.S. and the rest of the world is facing with COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rich. And I'll tell you, when I wrote the book, I had no clue that it'd be publishing in the middle of the worst pandemic in over 100 years. But in a lot of ways, our epidemic of insecurity has set the stage for the pandemic of coronavirus that we're suffering right now. And it's done so in two principal ways. The first is that it has taught us that we cannot invest in government. It's told us that government is part of the problem, of course, because there are many corporations out there who profiteer off of trying to do the things that government should be doing for us, but doing so for the profit of the very few at the very top of those corporations. And so we've bought into this governing consensus that's led us now to undercutting our public health infrastructure, the kind of public health infrastructure that should have been there for us to prevent this pandemic in the first place. And so that corporate capture of government for their profit and our loss is one way that this epidemic of insecurity has set us up for this pandemic. And the second is that we are struggling in this country in so many ways. The epidemic of insecurity has torn apart basic systems that we have relied on for a very long time that we find ourselves struggling to rely upon now, whether it's a healthcare system or an economic system that has traded away jobs for gigs, or a housing system that leaves more people evicted in communities across this country every year, or it is an environmental system that leaves us breathing the fumes of stuff that we plumb from the ground to burn into our air, that, you know, fails us in so many ways because both the climate change that it creates and also the way that it poisons our own children, or it's a political system that suppresses the votes of too many. And so you take these systems and you interlock them together and you realize that a pandemic like this one hits in large part because we fail to prevent it. And people are left super susceptible, not just because they don't have access to healthcare in a system that profiteers off of sick people, but it's also because they're more likely to lose that gig that they rely on. They're less likely to have public transit that is safe and reliable. They're less likely to be able to stand up and support politicians who believe in science because of voter suppression. And all of those things together have left us more susceptible to the consequences of COVID-19, which has, of course, taken 130,000 lives and counting, but also has taken so many more livelihoods in the process. And all of that set up because of this epidemic of insecurity.
Of course, you've actually lived that idea of having to rebuild a government capacity from your time as the health commissioner at the city of Detroit. When you took over in 2015, you were just trying to rebuild a public health network that had been privatized, frankly, by the previous administrations as a part of Detroit's bankruptcy. Public health had been outsourced to a nonprofit. Can you talk about trying to rebuild, you know, a government agency from scratch?
Yeah, that's right, Rich. I walked into a department that had 5 city employees and 85 contractors in the back of the building where people pay parking tickets every day. And put in perspective, Detroit was spending $1.50 per person per year on public health when I started. And we were barely scratching it. We had 5 people who, you know, included me, a deputy director, a couple of others, and that was it. And that decision was made when the city was facing bankruptcy and state takeover back in 2012. Now, you can imagine, right, what kind of circumstance leads us to believe that it is okay to privatize the basic public health functions in a major U.S. city, albeit a city that is predominantly Black. It is the largest majority Black city in the country, and a city whose racial history has been etched through every major moment of racial disruption and attempts at reconciliation. But all of this led to the city's bankruptcy, the dissolution of its public health department, and my job was to rebuild it. And I'll tell you, when I first started, I had no clue where we would go. How do you even bring it back? But in my role, I was touring one of our vaccination clinics, and I got to meet a little boy. He was 3 years old, the 4th child of a 21-year-old mom, met his father maybe 4 times in his life because his dad's in jail. But this kid had this irrepressible confidence and this sense of a world that was there for him. And I couldn't help, after meeting this boy, realizing how far our city had failed a boy like him, and that our responsibility in public health and frankly government was to justify the kind of inborn confidence that any child should have in the life that he or she is going to lead. And so we set about trying to rebuild our department to leverage health to disrupt intergenerational poverty, to take on those outcomes that affected a child's health, but we knew could go on to affect their ability to learn and earn in the long term. Outcomes like vision deficits. We knew that 30% of our kids who test positive for vision deficits wouldn't get a pair of glasses in that year. They'd come back testing positive again the year after that. And so we built a program to guarantee every child a free pair of glasses. We knew that lead poisoning derails the development of a brain, even as that brain is just starting to be able to be that sponge that takes up and soaks up information in the world. And so if we're able to take on lead poisoning in our city, then we would have a disproportionate impact on those children's ability to learn and earn. Another one is asthma. And a lot of folks don't know this, but if you have persistent asthma, on average, you're going to miss a day of school every 2 weeks. And that's not because you're playing hooky, it's because you can't breathe. And so if we can keep those kids breathing clearly, then we can keep them in the classroom and we can keep them learning. And so we set about trying to really focus on taking on those roles that government ought to be playing to being able to invest in our young people, to empower them both to be healthy, but also to be able to be their best in the world. And that's what government ought to be doing. But for too long, we have assented to a system that tells us that government is part of the problem rather than a key form of the solution. And that has been part and parcel of the epidemic of insecurity that I talk about in the book.
You mentioned your vision and initiative, and you talked to a young child that had got their first pair of glasses, and they're looking at their fingerprints.
You know, you don't imagine, if you're a little kid, you haven't been able to see the detail in your hand, right? That unique fingerprint that makes you uniquely you. And, you know, I'd put that pair of glasses on that little boy, and the first thing he did is look at his hands, and he was scared, and that wasn't the emotion that I was expecting. And he looks up at me, he says, you know, my hand's got wrinkles in it. And I said, yep. He said, is yours? And so I showed him my hand, and I said, well, you have to let me know. And he said, he reassured himself that it did. And then thought about it for a second. He said, does everybody's? And I said, well, look, you've got a new pair of glasses. You're going to have to go take a look. But we take it for granted. Often, these basic things, the ability just to observe your own hand, is something that everybody just gets to do. But that's not the case in communities where, because of the amalgam of the way that corporations have taken from these communities and the fact that governments have often failed these communities, that basic ability to just look at your hand and, you know, enjoy the wonder of the fingerprint that makes you uniquely you, that's taken away from people. And we have a real responsibility to build an America where everybody has that basic right to look at their hand and say, wow, this fingerprint is mine and mine alone.
You served as the health commissioner for the city of Detroit from 2015 to 2017. And as I mentioned, rebuilt the city's public health program. And you worked on issues ranging from very serious ones, from reducing sulfur dioxide emissions and children's exposure to lead, to reducing the feral dog population, which I don't think strikes people as, wow, that's something a health commissioner would do. But yes, when they're biting people in the streets, yes, you did. But I have to ask you, you know, you left to run for governor. But as I was reading your story, what you tell your life story as well as your story in politics, as an epidemiologist, has it been hard being an advocate in an advocate role as opposed to being a decision maker during this pandemic?
It's been incredibly hard. I somewhat feel like a general who's missed the war. And though my work has had me advocating around what a just response and a public health informed response to this coronavirus pandemic would be, and I routinely consult with public officials who are making those decisions, it is hard knowing that you're not on the front lines and that, you know, the work that you've trained your whole life to do actively needs doing, and you're not there in that position to do it. At the same time, I know that the tail of this pandemic is going to be very long, and there's a lot of work that we need to do to make sure that something like this never happens again. And I do hope that I have the opportunity to be a part of that kind of rebuilding to ensure that the next time an infectious disease emerges in some part of the world, that we are not caught without the public health infrastructure that we need to take it on, that we're not in a position where the poorest among us and people of color in our society suffer the worst, and where we are informed as a community about the underlying basic science of epidemiology and what we need to do collectively to ensure and engage with the reality of this and ensure that we're protecting people and that we are investing in one another.
Now, of course, in Michigan has been sort of the front lines for the protests against the reactions to public health pronouncements. You had, you know, people armed with weapons walking the halls of the state capitol, on the steps of the capitol, protesting the close down. As an epidemiologist, how do you react to that reaction?
Yeah, it is very frustrating to see. You know, I obviously ran for governor in Michigan and ran against the current governor in a primary. But I think she's done an admirable job in terms of holding fast and holding true to the science. We just celebrated July 4th holiday, and that holiday is unique because we're celebrating the moment that we decided as a society that we were going to build a democracy, a society where all of us had a stake in the decisions that were made. And that comes through the leaders that we elect. But that requires us to also be accountable to truth and reason and logic. And, you know, truth and reason and logic force us to really be engaging with the basic science of public health in a moment when we're facing a pandemic. And it's very clear to me that we have not done a great job as a society, both educating folks about how science works and what it means for us in moments of crisis. And then also that a lot of us are putting our own self-interest ahead of the collective good. And in a democracy, right, we believe that we can come together for the collective good. And I worry a lot about what this moment is teaching us about how much more work we need to do to build an educated public who understands the risks of a circumstance like this and what needs to be done to take it on, and also one where we have fully invested in one another. And we recognize that, you know, even if wearing a mask in public is really uncomfortable in the hot July sun, or, you know, not going to crowded places can be really frustrating for a long period of time, and that we are social animals and we enjoy being with one another, that we're doing this for the greater good and we're willing to make those sacrifices for one another as a society. And I worry about what this tells us about our civic fabric and what it means for the work we need to do to come together as a society to reify and reinvest in our democracy. And as a kid, you know, who grew up spending some of the summers in a country where there was no democracy, in Egypt, where my parents immigrated from, I know how precious what we have is, but also how much keeping and investment it takes to keep it up and to keep it healthy. And we've got a lot of catching up to do.
My guest today is Abdul El-Sayed, an epidemiologist, a public health activist, and progressive activist. He's the chair of Southpaw, Michigan. He ran for governor of Michigan in 2018, finished second in the Democratic primary. He's now the author of Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. It's published by Abrams Press. And you tell your life story as well as the story of your political campaign and your work as the health commissioner. But then you, second half of the book is about where you see where America is. And you really talk about the politics of insecurity. How did you decide that this insecurity is what's driving our politics and our zeitgeist today?
Well, when I was campaigning, I had thought that the, you know, epidemiologist that I had spent a long time building in my mind through my training would just need to take a back seat, right? And that I was going to be a candidate. And, you know, your training never really leaves you. And on those long car rides home from, you know, every which part of the state, you know, the epidemiologist would come out and reflect on a lot of what I was seeing and hearing. And when I started to run, I had thought the conventional wisdom was true, that if you were to talk to poor and working and retired Black folks in communities like Flint or Detroit, or poor or working or retired white folks in communities like Kalkaska or Michigan's Upper Peninsula, that they would have fundamentally different viewpoints on the challenges that we faced. And I was absolutely wrong. And I found that no matter who I talked to, their challenges and their worries were the same, that their kids were going to crumbling underfunded schools that were actively being privatized, that the water system, despite being the state with the highest amount of fresh water in the world, that their water systems were failing, that they were paying way too much for water that had been poisoned, that their health care was too expensive, that 10% of people didn't have it at all, that they were worried about whether or not they'd be able to find a job, or even worse, that their kids would be able to find a job in their part of the state. And all of that led me to the recognition that even though we don't get to have enough conversations together, the conversations that we're having at our kitchen tables are fundamentally the same. And they all go back to the fact that the systems that we've relied upon to be able to provide us with the basic means of a dignified life have been failing for a long time. And that failure all comes from a pretty similar place. The fact that major corporations have been able to profiteer off of these systems for a long time to our detriment, and that the firewall between our economic system and our political system has fallen, and those corporations are able to manipulate the rules for their own interests, which have accelerated this crumbling of these basic institutions. And so, you know, whether it's healthcare or housing or the economy or the voting system, all of them have started to exclude people, none more than low-income people and people of color, but all of us. And that has left us very worried about our future. And that's where this insecurity comes from. It is that anxiety that we have about the future state of our country and the country we're leaving behind for our kids and grandkids. And right now, in this moment of real change, of frustration, we have to decide that we are going to take this system on, we're going to rebuild all of the crumbling parts of it, and that we are going to do so together, because that's really the only choice we have.
I have to push back a little bit, because while the challenges might be identified as the same from a person from the Upper versus somebody from Flint or Detroit, their ideas on how to meet those challenges are pretty fundamentally different, aren't they?
Oftentimes that is true. But I think sometimes that's driven by the fact that they have never had the opportunity to communicate with one another about the fact that all of them are struggling in this moment. And I think what has happened is that the politics of this moment and this insecurity that exists in all of us has left us susceptible to demagoguery, to being told that the reason we don't have what we need to survive and thrive is because other people have taken it. And I think if we were able to come together beyond those divisions that exist in our society and recognize that actually all of us are in this boat together, and that oftentimes the people who are demagoguing and dividing us are the people who have so much of the wealth and have made so much of the profit off of these crumbling systems, that we may be able to come together and recognize that actually the solutions that we want to these problems have to focus on that common system rather than trying to fight with one another or to believe the demagogues who tell us that the reason that we're suffering and struggling is because others have what we don't have.
Now, I have to ask you, you profiled two people you spoke with during your governor's campaign. One was a custodian in the Detroit school system who couldn't drive because he couldn't afford the high insurance rates in Detroit because of Detroit's particular rules about auto insurance. He's walking, he's using public transit and buses, and to get to his job in the Detroit school system. And then you also spoke with a former classmate who self-described himself as a one percenter, you know, the 1% of highest wealth in the country. But you say both of them had a shared sense of insecurity about their circumstances. What does that tell us?
It tells us that we are not as divided as we think we are. And yet, we have allowed the inequality of this moment to continue to divide us. And we have a moment right now where we can either choose to allow this system that is dividing us both politically and also economically to do so indelibly or we can come together and recognize that the system's not working for anyone. You know, when you have somebody who is a one percenter in our society who still thinks he's poor, you have to ask yourself what it is about our society that's not providing the things that he needs and he feels like he needs to sustain himself. And I talk about this idea of a paradoxical insecurity in the book. And that paradoxical insecurity is the insecurity of my friend who I profile in the book. And it's the insecurity of someone who has means in a place where so many other people don't, that forces them to say, well, if I don't do this extra bit, if I don't profiteer off of this extra system, then I may find myself in the position where all of these people who suffer because of what I'm doing find themselves. And you see how the system has turned into a pernicious positive feedback loop. And so we need to come together as a society and say, well, look, nobody should suffer abject poverty in our society. Nobody should go without basic healthcare. Nobody should go without basic housing for themselves and their families. Our schools have to be the engine of equity, and it's no longer okay for poor kids in low-income school districts to get a lesser education that does not allow them access to the economic system. It's not okay for corporations to continue to dole out gigs rather than jobs that come with a fair wage and basic benefits. And if we don't do that, the short-term incentives of those in positions like my friends are going to continue to perpetuate a system where everybody suffers. And so I think we have a moment right now where we have to decide that this inequality is not okay, that the system that is incentivizing and driving it is failing us, and that the demagogues who rely on our vulnerability and susceptibility in this moment of insecurity should not be leading us to continue to perpetuate it further.
I'm struck by something Bill Clinton used to say in the 1990s when we were looking at a tax increase, and he began to see the economy boom. You know, he used to say, we should believe in this idea that a rising tide lifts all boats. If you're rich, you know, the rising tide lifts you just as much as it does somebody who have lesser means. You think people have left that idea behind? I think there's a sense that the one percenters don't want all the boats to rise. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I mean, and it seems from your book that they just suffer from the same insecurity that all of us have.
I think the point you're making is an important one. It's that right now we have been tricked into believing that the world is a zero-sum place, that either I have or they have, rather than building a system where all of us can have. And that will require us to be able to move beyond this insecurity that we're suffering and engage with one another with a level of empathy and a recognition that until and unless we are willing to invest in the well-being of everybody, then all of us will suffer. And there is no circumstance that's showing that more clearly than COVID-19, right? When any of us decide to put ourselves over the collective, all of us suffer. We're seeing these surges in states all over the country because we were in such a hurry to open up an economy rather than asking, well, how can we put our well-being first? Because there is no economy while COVID-19 is ravaging through us. People are not going to go out and shop when they think that they're at risk of catching a very serious, infectious, deadly disease. And so we are really in this boat together. And unless and until we're willing to invest in one another, I worry that our actions against each other are going to sink us all.
You describe that in the last section of the book where you're talking about empathy policies. My guest today is Abdul El-Sayed, an epidemiologist, public health activist, and the author of Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. He ran unsuccessfully for governor in 2018, and he runs a progressive activist group called South Paul, Michigan. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, when you start getting into empathetic policies, which you have a number which range from Medicare for all to a green and what you call a blue New Deal, which is talking about clean water, to election reform, comprehensive public safety reform, and a variety of other, including public banking, which I thought was a really interesting thought. You're always going to run into a couple of questions, and you tackle this right at the beginning. You're talking about COVID-19 and how we opened up too early. The whole idea, which has been asked at the same time with these questions, is how are you going to pay for that? How do you answer that question?
You know, I answer that in a couple of ways. Number one, we're all already paying for that. Now, take healthcare as an example. We pay 18% of every dollar spent in our economy is spent on healthcare. That is substantially more than every other high-income country in the world. And so we are already paying for that. And yet nobody asks the question of how are we paying for that now? And mind you, the fact that we're paying so much leaves 10% of Americans outside of our healthcare system. They just don't have health insurance at all. And so the question we ought to be asking is, how are we paying for it now? And how would we pay for it in a circumstance where everybody had access, equitable access to this thing? Because if you look at healthcare in Canada, for example, they spend about 11 cents on the dollar on healthcare to our 18 cents. They live 2 years longer than we do on average. And in survey after survey, they're happier with their healthcare system than we are with ours. And so it is our insecurity that tells us that if we were to change the system, it would just get worse, rather than perhaps we could do it better if, in fact, we were willing to break the chokehold that so many corporations have on this system so that their CEOs can make $10 to $30 million a year, while 10% of Americans don't have healthcare at all. And even for those who have it, you have to sit behind a paywall for half the year, which is a deductible, or have to pay for it out of your pocket every time you even get access to the insurance product you already paid for. We could do so much better if we were willing to move beyond the insecurity of, well, we can't pay for it right now, we just have to make do with what we have, to asking, what could the system actually be if we truly did put our ideals ahead of the interests of a very few?
You trained to be a doctor. You entered that system, and that system is all based on our medical system being incredibly highly paid, part of that for-profit system. How do you change that when so much of that system is geared on that model? How do you change that so quickly? What do you have to do for that doctor that took out a couple $100,000 in loans to become a doctor?
I'll be honest with you, right? The notion that somebody has to take out several hundred thousands of dollars to become a doctor is itself part of the problem, right? There's no reason why we can't address the fact that medical school is too expensive, that we can't even pay to educate our doctors, and at the same time, make sure that they're not then charging on the back end exorbitant costs for something that is mission critical to our lives, which is our healthcare. Medicare for All is an important solution because what it would do is create one government health insurance program. Doctors would continue to be privately operated and employed. They would still either work for themselves in medical practices or work for large hospital systems. But the difference is that the insurance industry, 7,000 insurers across the country, who exist simply as middlemen for providing healthcare, they go away. And with them goes the games that they play around leaving us without the healthcare that we need or negotiating higher rates to be able to buy in their competitors up and consolidate the system so that they run, in effect, virtual oligopolies or monopolies in local communities. And then what we then do is we pay a reasonable, thoughtful rate for the healthcare that is provided. And so I think that Medicare for All is the right solution. But to the bigger picture here, Rich, is that we as consumers of healthcare, and I don't even like that term, but we as people whose bodies need healing, we need to decide that we're not okay paying more than any other country in the world for a product that does not exist for 10% of us, and for which we have to pay a second time when we actually want to use it, so that CEOs of corporate insurance companies can make $10 to $30 million a year. It takes a movement of people deciding that the status quo isn't working, that it's not working for any of us, and it will take all of us to decide to fix it.
Abdul El Sayed is an epidemiologist, a public health activist, and the former commissioner for the City of Detroit's Public Health Department. He is the author of Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. It's published by Abrams Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.